is the New South Wales Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the program. David Claughton with you today. Michael Condon's still away, but he'll be back next week. On the program, what's the job future for the Hunter region look like? It's a key issue in the upcoming by-election, and if the government loses that one, it'll slip further into a minority. All the major parties have picked candidates with strong coal credentials, but environment groups are wondering, where are the policies that lay out the inevitable transition from coal?
While there is still definitely, obviously a coal export industry that is healthy, it is in decline. And so while we are in this position, before we get any further down the road towards the end of the industry, now is absolutely the time to be planning for and adjusting to changes in the coal market.
Love to hear your thoughts about that. Is coal in decline? Is now the time to change to a renewable sector or to something else? Our SMS is 0467 922 684. 0467 922 684. If you're a miner or a business that's reliant on the coal mining industry, we would love to hear from you. We will hear from someone from the Sustainable Institute at the University of Technology in Sydney and also from the AusMine Group, which represent a lot of the service industries in that sector. So joining me on the panel, Dr. Chris Briggs. Good afternoon.
Hi there.
And Chris Gibbs-Stewart from AusMine. Good afternoon, Christine.
Good afternoon.
So let's hear a bit more from the Nature Conservation Council about why they want the major parties to focus on a transition from coal.
This is not some far-off concern that we have, to worry about in the future. It's something that we have to worry about right now. And it's really disappointing to see that none of the major parties have articulated a plan for the Upper Hunter as the coal industry declines. We know that coal-fired power stations have closure dates in place. We also know that thermal coal and the export of coal is in decline. A lot of the countries that buy coal from Australia have commitments under the Paris Agreement that they are on track to meet. We saw a peak in coal exports a few years ago, and so the time has really, it's never been more urgent that we have a plan in place for coal mining communities.
It's never been more urgent. Jackie Mumford from the Nature Conservation Council. The National Party is saying coal is still the driver for the industry there yet for quite a while to come.
We've got some great cattle country. We've got our horse studs. We've got great wine industry. And, of course, the big power economically is coal. And mining in our region really is driving, economic development here and there's a lot of jobs, and I'm particularly feel strongly about the support industry around coal. There's a lot of small businesses that rely on those mines, and there's a lot of people out there who rely on the work that the mines give them, and that's a great thing for our region because families can be sure of the fact that this region will be strong now and a long time into the future.
That's Clarencetown Construction Manager David Lazel, who's the candidate for the Nationals in the Upper Hunter region. So can I come to you first, Chris Gibbs-Stewart from AusMine. What's your take on that? I mean, he's obviously clearly talking about your membership there. What's your sense of the coal industry and whether it's in decline?
Well, we certainly know coal is very important to New South Wales, and our organisation has over 150 members in New South Wales, and the majority of those are in the Hunter region. And we know that the great majority of those do work in coal. When I say the great majority, over 80% of those companies work in coal. So it is a vital industry for the area, and it's not going away quickly.
And are you seeing a decline in jobs at all?
We're not seeing a decline in jobs, no.
Because exports are pretty strong still, aren't they?
Exports are pretty strong, and what people don't realize about the supply sector is that they're very diversified. They not only work in coal, but they work in other commodities as well. And they also work in other industries. So the other thing we know is about 80% of our members and of the MET sectors, so the mining equipment technology and services sector, work across a broad range of industries. And in fact, the MET sector is also part of the renewables story. because about 32% of MET sector companies in New South Wales already work in renewables.
MET sector being sort of medium-sized enterprises?
No, METS stands for Mining Equipment Technology and Services Sector.
Okay.
So that's the constituency we represent, the METS sector.
And so some of your membership have already moved into renewables?
Yeah, absolutely. We have members that make components for solar and wind. We have members who, make transformers and gearboxes. And, you know, there's all kinds of engineering services which go around the renewables industry, which our members are involved with. And, in fact, if you think about renewables in terms of wind and solar and, you know, the big installations in remote locations, they aren't too dissimilar from what a mining operation is. And so there's a lot of transferable skills from mining into renewables.
Well, the Labor position is a bit unclear when it comes to renewables jobs. Here's the Labor leader, Jodie Mackay.
I think that is exactly the question. I think that's what we need to look at, and I don't think the National Party has been able to land on a place here that gives people comfort that they are going to have a job into the future. And if it's not about them, then it's about their kids. We have at the moment, we have those who support the coal industry in one corner, we have those who don't. As Jeff said, every time you open the paper, you see that people are having a go at coal miners. The conversation should be about how we move everyone closer together so that we can protect and respect our coal jobs, but also look at growing jobs. And, you know, people talk about the renewables. Well, what are the jobs in the renewables? No one's actually defined what that is. Manufacturing is huge. Yeah. Thousands and thousands of jobs have been sent overseas to construct our trains and our buses and our ferries. So we need to look at how we build things in New South Wales. And for me, the Hunter, the Upper Hunter, should be the epicentre of that. So we've got a bill before the Parliament where we're trying to lock the government into this approach. So we want to see it legislated. So, you know, we think this is important, but, we've got to protect our agricultural jobs. We've got to look at tourism jobs. We've got to be supporting jobs for those who work in the national parks around Gloucester and Barrington, Gloucester and Dungog, for instance. At the moment, there is no voice for the coal industry in the Parliament.
I was really surprised by that comment because I would have thought the coal industry lobby would have quite a lot of power in Parliament. Dr. Chris Briggs, I'll bring you in from the Sustainable Institute. What's your sense of the power that the mining industry has in Parliament at the moment?
Yeah, well, I guess it's a polarised debate, isn't it? And that's why every election we sort of seem to end up in quite a similar space where we're talking about the future of jobs and jobs versus environment. I guess our research has tried to look at what some of the future jobs and renewables might be referred to there in that comment. And what we found based on a large-scale survey applied to scenarios used by the energy market operator about where our system could go is that it could create around 45,000 construction and operation and maintenance jobs. So these are working on wind farms, hydro, solar farms. It's maintenance technicians, electrical and mechanical technicians. There are other opportunities which we didn't look at in the survey. For example, there'll be demand for other types of mining for resources used by renewables, such as lithium, copper, rare earths. There'll be supply chain jobs of the type that Christine just mentioned, making transformers and other things. And there'll be opportunities in potentially also in heavy industry based on renewables. As the globe shifts to renewables, we stand to have a competitive advantage because we have very good low-cost solar, wind and hydro resources. So, I guess we're still frustratingly at the sort of point where we're having these debates.
There's reason for the debates because you say there could be 45,000 jobs, but if you just looked at Muswellbrook Shire, there's only 125 renewable jobs there, according to the mayor, and 3,800 coal jobs. So the balance is still clearly in favour of coal at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the things we did look at. I mean, it's one thing to say there'll be that 45,000 jobs, but where are they and what type of jobs are they? And renewables scatters jobs throughout regional areas, whereas coal tends to concentrate them in regions. So that's a real problem, absolutely.
Chris Gibbs-Stewart from Moss Mine, do you see that as an issue too? If there is a transition, and I'm thinking there is, but maybe the agreement's and there's not a lot of agreement about when that's going to happen. But do you, there'll be dislocation, do you think, when mines shut down and workers may have to move locations to find new jobs in renewables or whatever?
Well, we know that the MET sector is highly mobile already, and they are probably working outside of the area where their business is located. And that's evidenced by, you know, the amount of branches and other offices that our members in the sector has in other states. So, you know, I think when you're looking at coal, you're talking really about a generational shift. It's not going to happen overnight. And I think businesses, smart businesses, will plan for the future, and so they'll adjust what they need to do accordingly.
And the kinds of jobs that are available here, if you looked at the ABS figures, they're saying nationally there's about 26,000 jobs, or there were in 2019, but it's been going up incredibly, like 27% in the year before that, 120% over 10 years. That figure of 45,000 does seem credible. Would you agree, Chris Gibbs?
Yes, I mean, I don't really have any figures on that, so I'll take what Chris said. But yes, it does seem credible.
But a lot of those jobs might be just installing rooftop solar. Like, that's half of the jobs at the moment. So it doesn't sound terribly exciting for someone who's working in a mine, for example.
Well, if we're going to get a large load, if we're really going to use it as an energy source, I don't think it's going to be about rooftop solar. It's going to be large installations of solar or wind or hydrogen plants. I mean, they're talking about in Wollongong, Twiggy Forest investing in that, and there's going to be a lot of jobs generated around that. And no doubt there will be skills transferable from the mining industry into those type of projects.
Hydrogen's a very interesting area. Dr. Chris Briggs, what's your sense of hydrogen as an opportunity?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's one that people in the Hunter are looking at. I understand there are feasibility studies going on. And it's obviously very attractive because it includes the transfer of industry capability and skills that are already there. And I guess for an area like the Hunter, that's really what you're looking at. It's more around things like hydrogen. It's around the supply chain jobs. And it's looking around what types of heavy industry you might be able to build around renewables in the way that we've built around coal previously, like green steel. So hydrogen and a range of these other things are definitely what we should be looking at.
And aluminium too. You've got the Tomago aluminium smelter there. Is there much opportunity to convert that to a renewable?
Well, I think what people are starting to look at and realise is that in a global system that's based around renewables, the countries that have the best renewable resources will then start to get a comparative advantage in energy because you can't ship renewable energy or not without the same costs like when you move hydrogen. And so our aluminium producers might well end up with a comparative advantage if we play this right based on co-location or use of renewable energy.
What about the renewable energy zone? Because that government has actually put that in place. They've put quite a lot of energy, in fact, into renewable energy development in the state. Chris Gibbs, Stuart, is your sector benefiting from that?
Well, I think it's early days. We've been involved with some brainstorming around the renewable energy zone in the Central West. We participated in some workshops out there to look at what it might mean for our sector. And, you know, what I can say about it is that people are excited about the investment. It is, or it will help local companies diversify. And you'll find pockets of industry already out in that area who are involved in renewable projects. So I don't know what the plans for the Hunter are. I know that, you know, they've earmarked that for a zone as well. But industry is excited about it, that's for sure.
Getting some text through on our SMS line, 0467 922 684. Greg saying coal exports are predicted to increase through to 2040, according to our major ports, Japan, China, India, all building coal-fired power plants as we speak. They're far better off with our good stuff than the rubbish that's dug up elsewhere. As a farmer, even I can see coal has plenty of years left to run. Dr. Chris Briggs, what's your sense of when a transition is necessary? Does it have to happen now, or is there still 20 years to go?
Well, look, the truth is no one knows how quick the transition is coming, but it's certainly coming. Some of those countries you mentioned have signed up for net zero commitments, and so I don't, you know, the export forecasts tend to draw a straight line upwards in a lot of cases, but it's not what for example, the International Energy Agency is projecting. But the truth is we don't know, but if we wait and wait until it happens, then the outcomes are not likely to be very good for regions that are dependent on coal. So it's not a question, I guess, of getting out of coal now, but it is a question of trying to diversify the region's economy and prepare workers and businesses for a transition that's coming at some point. Locally, it's certainly coming quicker than that because the growth of renewables is happening much faster than predicted. So it's really about preparing for a transition that no one knows exactly when it's going to come, but if you wait, it's not going to be a pleasant outcome.
What about policies? Chris Gibbs, Stewart, Osmine, have you got, have you been talking to the government about specific policies that might help the sector transition over the next period of time, 10, 20 years?
Well, I guess there's all kinds of programs available right now for businesses to help them look at the future and plan to be more sustainable and competitive. You know, the federal government's modern manufacturing strategy is one that is really helping manufacturers in particular transform what they're doing both internally and externally so that they can meet the requirements of their customers in the future or of the market in the future. So there are programs available to help companies look at that, but I do think there is a lack of a cohesive overall program or policy that really looks at that transitional element because, you know, I agree with what Chris is saying. The more we are prepared, the better it will be for those companies involved.
And Chris Briggs, what do you think about policies? What do you reckon would be useful at this time for that region?
Well, I think the renewable energy zone is an excellent issue, just to pick on that, and it is early days, but certainly I know they're looking at a range of policy options that might promote supply chain jobs in the area. I think broadly, nationally, I think we need some sort of plan that provide some certainty around timing, like Germany has a phase out for 2035, 2038, for example. There are other countries like the European Union are setting up transition authorities with a $17 billion war chest to try and help these regions grow alternative industries and businesses. So I guess we'd like to see a policy like that that actually facilitates a transition rather than the sort of annual political slugfest that comes around when there's an election on.
Yes, well, it is a crucial election, and then beyond that, you've got federal elections too, which may determine more critical policies around this issue. Thank you both. Any last comments? Quick summation?
Well, I guess I don't think it's an either-or. I don't know why people are fighting against each other. We have a lot of great companies in the Hunter who are working both in mining and working in renewables. And I think, you know, from a political point of view, the politicians need to really understand what these companies are doing so they're not pitting companies against each other. The political landscape is just more harmonious, I guess.
Dr. Briggs?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think it's not going away tomorrow, but we need a transition plan and we need to get past some of the politics to start growing and putting policies in place to grow the future jobs.
Thanks both of you for joining the Country Hour today.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Chris Briggs and Chris Gibbs-Stewart. She's from Osmine. He's from the Sustainable Futures Institute at the University of Technology in Sydney.
The New South Wales Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
On the SMS, Jeff saying if we're stupid enough to ditch the biggest income earner that our country has, then we deserve everything we get. Don't take any notice of the transition nitwits. And we had Sue Abbott contacting us on the SMS line, who's the Upper Hunter Greens candidate, asking to have a say. So we may do that another day. But thank you for contacting us, Chris. And send your SMSs through 0467 922 684, particularly if you're working in the mining industry. Or you're working in renewables, what's that career path like? 0467 922 684. Well, we've seen the Royal Easter Show come and go, and wasn't that an incredible success? And one person who has played a major role in the Sydney show over the years is Angus Lane. He's been the chief announcer at many shows, including the Toowoomba Royal Show, and he's chosen that event to hang up his microphone. While he's going to be at a few more events in Queensland this year, it'll be his final time announcing at that level. Mr. Lane's dulcet tones have been wafting over show rings across Australia for more than three decades, and along with his wife Vicky, he's seen some of the best of the best. He told Ali Fenton Taylor that the time is right.
So this is where I started. I started in a miniature arena, would you believe, back in 89 or 90. It's been wonderful. And it's just been a joy to be part of the Royal Agricultural Society of Queensland for all those years and celebrating 30 years or 31 years this year. So I feel very blessed. And I pay tribute to my lovely wife, Vicky, who unfortunately is not with me this year, but we've just worked as a team and we've just loved every moment of what we do, and particularly everything to do with the cattle, the dairy cattle. I mean, the shows are all about agriculture to me, and it's all about the best of the best. So what better way to spend your life?
And not just the Royal here in Queensland, other shows around the country have experienced the best of the best in Angus Lane. You've been the voice of shows for so long.
Mm-hmm.
What made you love it for that long? What made it your passion?
I was just a little boy growing up in Brisbane, and I sat on Machinery Hill when my mum said to me when I was 9 years of age, if you could do anything at the Royal Show in Brisbane, what would it be? I said, I'd like to take that microphone and be the Royal Show ring announcer. And it was always a dream. I had 30 years in the land, which was a great education for me. I learned about the needs and the requirements of drought and floods and hard times. And I saw the needs of people particularly, and that's so much part of what we're doing now. So I think that just enthused me. Look, it's just that passion that I have for agriculture. I just love primary producers. I love what they represent. I just love what the shows represent. You know, to me, shows are the greatest things on earth.
What are your highlights? I mean, the show reel is long, I imagine.
Yeah, it is, and without a doubt. I mean, being appointed chief announcer of the Echo in 92, that was my dream, to be at the Echo, because I grew up in Brisbane, to be here at the Toowoomba Royal Show Society, and then I was on the long list for the Olympic Games for the show dumping in 2000, and I chose to go to the Perth Royal Show for my very first time. I've had 20 years at Perth, and we've just enjoyed travelling Australia. But look, there's been so many highlights, and I dare say just seeing the success of this next generation has been just one of the greatest highlights for me, seeing the success of the next generation coming through, following their fathers and their grandfathers' footsteps and continuing the passion. There's nothing like it, and I just wish them all well. And particularly coming up to the Beef Expo in Rockhampton, where I've had the pleasure of being up there since 91 too.
What do you see as the future of shows in Australia?
I see them as being great. I think it's just a matter of people making sure they support their shows and become a volunteer. There's nothing nicer than volunteering your services to be involved in shows. But I think we've got some great leaders and we have some great examples for people to follow on. There's an exciting time ahead, and that's why I believe it's time for me. We've had COVID. I didn't do an event for 12 months. My last event last year was Oakey, and I started Oakey again this year. There's so many challenges ahead for people, and in getting back into the swing of it as well. Also, for personal reasons, with my wife Vicky, who's been suffering, cancer's a terrible thing. And just God bless her, because without her, I'd never have had the success in my life. Whoever follows us, I wish them well. And all I can do is just to hope and pray that they've had and have a great journey just like we've had.
You're an absolutely wonderful team, and our best thoughts with you and with Vicky into the future. Your succession plan, do you have someone working with you at the moment, looking to I mean, they're huge boots to fill, I dare say.
I do, and again, thanks to Vicky. Vicky's done a lot of hard work behind the scenes in putting together some books, information for young Jake Smith, who's up with me this year at Toowoomba Royal Show. And we believe in that so much. And there's also Lindsay Douglas that has just been superb. And also Tim Dreverman, another young gentleman that's at the Sydney Royal Show. And also there's another young fellow up in the Darling Downs, Justin Matthews. But I just say to all those that would like to be announcer, become a storyteller. Anyone can do announcing. Anyone can do results. Anyone can just say, well, ladies and gentlemen, we have the Australian Stock Horse Gelding class or whatever. But learn to become a storyteller. It's so important, because there's generations of people that have given their blood and their sweat and their tears to make a successful business as primary producers and also exhibitors at shows. So to all those young people, my advice is simply become a storyteller. And I just wish them all the very best for the future. And I know Jake... He's excited to be up at the Beef Expo. He's excited to going right through to Cairns and Darwin. And I'm so pleased that those show societies actually allowed me to nominate someone, as they did in Central Queensland with Lindsay Douglas. So I wish them all well.
The voice of the show's Angus Lane speaking with Ali Felton Taylor. He's retiring after 30 years, and I think he was also Father of the Year in the early 2000s, and I'm pretty sure he has a Queen's Honour as well. Remarkable career. Love to have your thoughts about Angus Lane if you've had a relationship with him and seen him work. 0467 922 684, your memories of his career. On the issue of coal and the transition to renewables, Mark in the Hunter Valley says, smart businesses plan for the future, in quotation marks. I think that was what one of our guests said today. Such a shame we don't have any smart candidates, he says, planning for the future. To put all your eggs in one basket may be the undoing of the major parties. I feel for current workers in the coal industry, he says, that they don't have politicians planning for their long-term future and not just the next election cycle. It's 12:30 on the Country Hour. Adam Storey's here with news headlines.
Thanks, Dave. Federal and state health authorities are continuing to investigate if the death of a 48-year-old New South Wales woman is linked to the AstraZeneca vaccine. The woman had diabetes and other health issues, and the Premier says the AstraZeneca rollout for more than 2 million people over the age of 50 will continue. The Defence Minister, Peter Dutton, says he's made it very clear to the Navy that a dance performance at a recent ship commissioning will never happen again. The performance on Saturday at the former launching of HMAS Supply has been widely criticised because it included twerking. The US President Joe Biden says he's informed his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin of his intention to hold the Kremlin to account for interference in last year's presidential election. The Biden administration will impose tough new sanctions against dozens of Russian companies and individuals and expel 10 Russian diplomats. And a bit of sport to finish off with. It's the Sheffield Shield final, and the Blues were all out for 143 yesterday. Queensland resumed this morning at 1 for 58, and they haven't lost a wicket so far, and they're 1 for 119 at lunch. So that's Queensland right. Firmly in control there.
Going down.
They're going down, I'm afraid.
And twerking.
Twerking.
What's going on?
Well, it's up to the individual as to whether one's offended by twerking or not.
No, I'm just kind of curious about what they thought was appropriate for that particular event. But
well, yeah.
Yeah.
To be honest, I didn't blink.
No. All right. All right. Let's find out what's happening with the weather. And David Walkie's at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, David. How are you going?
Very well, thank you. What's the weather doing?
Well, it's doing a few things. So we've had a front which has moved about coastal parts. It's brought a bit of a change to parts of the southern central coast of New South Wales. A few isolated showers around, but we haven't really seen too much out of them. And there's also a cloud band that's starting to thicken up a little bit over the northern parts of New South Wales. And so there isn't much rain out of that either, but that's expected to change as it starts to track east. And we're expecting to see a bit of rainfall developing about parts of northwest and northeast of the state as we head into tonight and tomorrow. So I guess that's the main story, is sort of had a bit of a cooling trend and some rain starting to develop.
All right, and yesterday we talked a bit about totals that might be expected. We're sort of one day closer. So you got any more clarity around that?
Yeah, we do. I think things have been a little bit more consistent than they have with previous events we've had, which has been good. So it looks currently like the focus of rainfall is going to be between about Coffs Harbour and Taree, those sorts of coastal areas. The highest total. So I think generally expecting somewhere between sort of 40 to potentially 80 millimetres along that coastal strip. Might even get a little bit more in some areas depending on exactly, you know, where the showers tend to line up. So another hot spot will be around the Barrington Tops area. We might get sort of 40 to 80 millimetres up on those ranges that typically get quite a bit of rain in this setup. And then through parts of the northwest, I think expecting somewhere sort of 15 to 40 millimetres across in areas around, say, Moree, those kind of places will be on the cards. There's a risk of some storms that will be pretty hit and miss, I think, through parts of the central west around Dubbo tomorrow, but also a chance for the far northeast, so northern rivers, but not expecting a whole lot of rain with them. Or if we do get some rain, it'll be fairly isolated, I think, the heavier totals. So really the focus, as I mentioned, between Coffs and Taree and then stretching up into the adjacent ranges.
All right, and further out?
Yeah, so it's really a one-day event. I think as we move into Sunday, maybe see a lingering shower or two along the northern coast, but starting to clear off and become fairly sunny for much of the rest of the state. And that pattern's pretty persistent for the next week, really. I mean, we'll have a few fronts that will push through, and they'll just clip the south of our state. So alpine areas and places in the south might pick up a shower or maybe some snow above 1,800 metres, so just around the resorts and those sorts of places on Tuesday and Thursday. But otherwise, it's pretty persistent pattern, and I think that really the only change would be a bit of wind as these fronts push through, but otherwise fairly dry.
All right. Thanks very much, David.
Thank you.
David Wilkie from the Bureau of Meteorology on the Country Hour, 25 to 1.
You're listening to the New South Wales Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
On the text line, Mandy says, thanks for the great discussion about the coal transition. I really hope that the wind and solar industrial facilities, she says in quotation marks, not wind and solar farms, will be classified as industrial land and not farmland. Correct terminology is essential, she says, to create equity for rural ratepayers. People often raise issues about solar farms or solar industrial facilities, about their presence on good farmland and also about the waste they produce and what will happen with them. Can that be recycled? Interesting questions we may be able to delve into the future. 0467 922 684 is our SMS if you've got thoughts about that. Let's turn to the water now, and significant flows travelling down the Barwon River have peaked much lower than predicted in Walgett in the northwest of the state. There's minor flooding occurring in the Barwon at Walgett, with the river there currently at 10.96 metres and falling. The river peaked in town last week at 11.92 metres, but there were initial concerns it would reach as high as 12.5 metres. The minor flood peak is expected in Brewarrina today at around 6.9 metres. Walgett Merino stud farmer John Wheaton lives on the river. He thinks it's very positive that the river is only in a minor flood.
You'd almost describe it as not an ideal flood as such, but there's been some inconvenience, but it's, I think, environmentally and I guess for people's morale and everything, it's probably been a good flood because it's about 30 centimetres less than 2011 and about a metre to 1.2 less than 2012, which was significant. 2012 was probably the biggest flood we've had here since the big floods of 1974, 1976. 2012 was quite significant. You probably had, in our case, 60 to 70% of the property underwater. And so this time we actually had nice fine weather and the ability to prepare for what they thought was going to be around 2011 levels. Mm. It didn't translate to that, but it still probably left most of the people on our road out here isolated for around 10 days without a long trip around. There's been no undue heartache. I think people have had plenty of time, so they probably haven't lost any livestock as such. I would think there's been, because of the amount of debris that came down, I think there's probably been considerable amount of on and near river infrastructure lost with fences and things near the river. I think it's probably been a very, very good environmental flow. It's given the system a really good clean out, filled all of the off river little lagoons, and it's probably, we're going to look upon it as a fairly favourable event, I would have thought. The long-term benefit to the communities and to the environment will be good. And I think it's enabled the irrigators to probably get all of their storages full, and that's going to translate to something good happening for them and thus for the communities that they reside in.
Can you explain to me what it's doing at the moment for your operations?
We've been getting all the sheep crutched, clicked, and moved north. We probably won't need to move as far north as we thought now. But everyone I've spoken to has basically been doing the same sort of thing. I think probably, sadly, people are so reluctant in the various departments to perhaps give predictions, and I think that's very sad. It's obviously a litigation thing. But once upon a time, you know, we would talk to, the older residents up the river, and now we're the older residents. I see two things happening. I see people being in advisory areas, being unwilling to make predictions for fear of being wrong. And I think people are then relying on the information that they have or haven't got to make a decision themselves, and I think that's rather unfortunate. I think this should almost, you know, we all seek advice, but if it's not quite right, you shouldn't be looking to blame anyone, is probably what I'm saying. Some people have had a little bit of farming country flooded with water. That's obviously a plus. I think the negative is that in some areas we're having a wonderful, wonderful season and we've drowned a little bit of feed, which is unfortunate. I think the other negative would be is there would certainly be some damage, as I said, to on-river infrastructure, as in fences and river crossings and stuff like that. I think it's probably a good thing that it wasn't a more major flooding event, because it's probably done more good at the moment than it's done harm.
Walgett Merino stud farmer John Whitten speaking with Lucy Thackray about that flood event that's making its way through the west of the state. On our text line, had a few people commenting still on that coal issue. David says, Pit Coal Cairn, I participated in the Central West Orana REZ, that's the Renewable Energy Zone outline, by the New South Wales DPIE just yesterday. He says it sounds like a hodgepodge mess based on fantasy propaganda. I guess the draft outline was produced in Beijing, says Pete at Coal Cairn. 0467 922 684 is our SMS. Jock remembers back to his early days of renewable energy. We had a windmill, he says, to pump water to the garden when we were children, and so did our neighbours. When the power came through, we converted to an electric pressure pump and the renewable windmill became redundant. And Matt says, if you have an export market for coal in the developing countries, even if we don't use it here, they might need it for another 50 years. Should be supporting coal, he says. It's only fair that they get reliable energy the same as we had. 0467 922 684. Let's move to grains now. And Grain Producers Australia is hoping to implement a single grains industry induction tool that will allow access to a number of sites across the country. Currently, growers have to be inducted onto a number of different sites, but GPA is working with the different grain handling companies to have the same induction safety ticket. Chairman of GPA, Andrew Wiedemann, says they are already have a grain site induction platform online for farmers, but he's hoping to have companies on board as well.
The tool that we're promoting is under the GPA training banner for site induction, and we believe it's the industry solution that is needed to try and make sure that we have a consistent model right across all of the bulk handlers that are receiving grain and packing houses and people that are buying grain off farmers and processing it. But also for farmers themselves on their own farm, having just the one program which actually suits their own business as well means that they don't have a multiple number of different courses that they're going to have to do before they enter a lot of sites. In my own case, I've got four different tickets to four different sites, and it just becomes a bit of a nightmare in keeping them updated. So for this instance, what we're looking at is having one card or one entry point, which is obviously given to the companies that people are going into, so that they're covered in terms of the laws and the workplace safety that they're requiring for their site induction into their grain sites.
How different would inductions be at the current moment between different sites?
Yeah, so look, in some instances, companies don't have anything, and a lot have talked to us that they are about to implement these, and there has been a lot of grower pushback, obviously, for the various reasons on those. So what we're saying is let's have one induction that covers all of the different sites, and the meeting that we're holding is all about trying to be collegiate with the industry and working to try and solve the issue of site induction for a range of industry stakeholders.
Would this, you said before that you're looking at having this induction for on farm as well, so would it be similar to what you might see going on to, say, a silo site?
Yes, it is. So the course that's on site on the GPA training website is there at the moment for farmers to link up to, and it's free for the range of things that we're doing at the moment as well. So, you know, people can go to the website and take a look themselves and go through the various things that are on the website. So there is a free component for some of the entry points, but there's also a paid silver membership, which would then cover across all the jurisdictions that we're talking about.
Is there anything that wouldn't work being across the board, across the different states as part of this induction?
Look, safety is the number one priority for everybody in the industry. And clearly, you know, our record in agriculture needs to be lifted. So we've also taken the push from the GPA board as well to try and make sure that safety is a priority. And it's, you know, should be everybody's priority. With the changes to the workplace health and safety laws, making you know, manslaughter a culpable act on a workplace that changed a couple of years ago, you know, we want to make sure that farmers at least have some level of understanding when they're employing people as well. But you know, the real emphasis of this at the moment is all about making sure that, you know, the site induction process is managed well, and that growers don't have a multitude of different programs that they're having to sign up to and keep reinstated. So having one that is recognised, but also it's also practical on their own farm, makes perfect sense to us as farmers.
You're going to be meeting with grain handling companies to look at this implementation of the induction tool. Have you had much of a response from them so far about what they would like to see and if this will be welcomed?
Yeah, so look, the program has been built specifically over the last 12 months through COVID, with input from a range of various industry people. And we've already got a number of businesses that have signed up, such as Belco as a hay processor and a couple of other end users that have been using the program. So it's really starting to take legs. And I think most people are now, with the COVID processor, are really aware of how to do things online, and training has become a much easier aspect for a lot of people, that they can do it in their own time. And as well as that, you know, we're trying to make sure that this is as ready as possible to suit all of the bulk handlers, and the feedback we've had so far is that it'll meet the needs that's required. Some may have a specific site induction process they want, but again, you know, that's all doable through the training process to allow for the various different sites to be managed as well, in, for say, larger grain storers like a company like GrainCorp or a Viterra or an AWB cargo.
Just finally, Andrew Wiedemann, it's not about cutting corners or anything like that. It's about making it as streamlined as possible, but keeping everyone as safe as possible.
That's correct, and making sure that we're all complying with what's required now in terms of workplace and health and safety laws and regulations that are now obviously being more strongly promoted. And obviously our industry, again, you know, the GPA board's taken a position to try and make sure that safety is number one, because it should be.
And it may well be a big issue this season. It's going to be quite likely, it's very early, but quite likely to be another bumper harvest. That's the chairman of the Grain Producers Australia, Andrew Wiedemann.
The New South Wales Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
David Claughton with you today. We were talking coal in the first half of the program, and we had a text from the Greens candidate in the Upper Hunter. And she says, it's disappointing that you gave the National Party airtime, but not the Greens. I agree with your guest that we don't have to choose between protecting the environment or protecting good jobs, but you can do both, and we must. Coal is in decline, she says, and bearing in mind that our two biggest coal customers have declared they'll be net zero by 2050, we can assume that they'll be out of coal long before then. We need to be building renewable infrastructure to electrify industry, and then downstream jobs will flow, she says. Green steel, green aluminium, green manufacturing, electric buses. Climate change is here, whether you like it or not, and she wants to see things develop quicker. Sue Abbott, the Upper Hunter Greens candidate, just remarked that the Greens only got less than 5% of the vote at the last election, and so we are focusing most of our time on the major candidates. Well, head to the north of the state now, Tamworth, where horses are the focus of the day. One breed in particular, the Australian Stock Horse. It's their national show, which is underway around about lunchtime today. Horses and riders already in the ring. I'm joined by the Society Chief Executive, Andrew Cooper. Good afternoon, Andrew.
Hi, David. How are you?
Very well, thank you. What's it looking like out there at the Livestock Centre?
Fantastic. We had an early start. We actually started 6 a.m. this morning, the first of our camp drive. So we've got a very big program at our national show. It's our 50th year, and if I can add it in, it's we're very lucky to have R.M. Williams as our naming rights sponsor this year. So having sponsors is a challenge, particularly in the last 12 months with events not going ahead. So we're just appreciative for companies like R.M.'s coming on board with us.
So was last year your 50th, that you had to hold it off?
No, this year is our 50th anniversary, so...
Happy days.
Yeah, the event was cancelled. So it's all happening around about now, because the very first meeting, and it sort of goes back that the breed was developing over the late 1800s. So there's a bit of PA going in the background there. Late 1800s, early 1900s, that this horse, this stocky working horse, was developed out of a number of different breeds. From that, a number of people got together and said, we need to protect this. There was other breeds moving into the country, and we felt that, or these guys felt that they needed to protect this breed, this type. And that's, they got together, and the first meeting was held in Wellington in March 71. Next meeting a few weeks after that was in Scone. And then yep. Straight after that, there was a meeting at the Royal Easter Show, and then the first general meeting was here in Tamworth.
So, and is the breed today much different from when it was then?
Has evolved, but still very much it's all about the type and, you know, what we call the breed for every need, whether it's camp draft, working stock, show jumping, dressage, anything, polo cross. It's such a versatile, beautiful breed.
And what are we seeing? What's happening there today in terms of competition? What sort of activities?
Camp draft mostly today. We've had the ladies and what we call the maiden series. It's one of our premier events, so that's on at the moment. And dressage, so that's the main things going on today. But we've got the parade of our sale horses. We've got yearlings, 2- and 3-year-old sale tomorrow, but there's a parade of those this afternoon.
What's the market like for stock horses? I mean, we know the thoroughbred industry's gone bananas.
Yeah, amazing this year. If you look at the sales that have happened, Dolby, New Train Classic earlier in the year, the average prices are way up. So, you know, once it rains and cattle prices go up, horses are definitely required.
So the Fountain of Youth sale is on tomorrow?
That's tomorrow afternoon, yeah. So there are only two yearlings, 2- and 3-year-olds that we sell, led or ridden.
Right. Well, we wish you the best. Before I go, though, Angus Lane, he's retiring today. He's been seen at shows all around the country for the last 3 decades. Did you ever work with him?
I did. I was actually involved at the I worked at the Royal Easter Show for 15 years, and I was involved in the horse section there for a very long time, and Angus was a commentator there, and I used to run into him at country shows and whenever we toured doing stuff. And yeah, Angus and Vicky were just an amazing team, and he was an amazing commentator, so he'll be missed because he's an amazing gentleman.
Any behind the scenes stories?
Oh, I couldn't possibly tell you those. No, I've got to tell you, he's one of nature's gentlemen, just the nicest fellow you could ever want to meet.
Yes, someone else texted us to say the same thing. Angus Lane, they don't make them anymore. A true gentleman, he will never be replaced. Thanks for your time today, Andrew.
Thanks, David. Appreciate it.
Andrew Cooper, who's at the Australian Stock Horses National Show, which started this morning at 6, and the Fountain of Youth sale is on tomorrow. Let's go quickly to strawberries, because farmers may be facing higher production costs but lower returns, as recent studies show the link between rising temperatures and smaller fruit. Principal horticulturalist from the Queensland Department of Agriculture and Fisheries, Christopher Menzel, has been conducting field tests at the research station near Nambour. It's not all bad news, according to Mr. Menzel. He told Melanie Groves that the breeding of heat-resistant varieties and potentially planting earlier could help to mitigate the challenges.
Well, strawberries, like a lot of crop plants, are very sensitive to growing conditions, particularly temperature. And one of the things about strawberries is in warmer weather, the fruit becomes small. And, of course, that is an issue for the economics of production. And with global warming, you know, the temperatures are increasing over time. And so even here at Nambour, the records show that the night temperatures have gone up by about 3 degrees over the last 50 to 60 years, which is quite significant.
So what exactly have these changing temperatures meant for strawberries and for growing strawberries in the Sunshine Coast and in broader Australia?
Well, like I say, the temperature affects many aspects of development and yield in strawberries. So one of the important factors is the size of the fruit, and the size of the fruit is very sensitive to temperature. So we just conducted a field trial where we looked at the relationship between the size of the fruit and temperature over the growing season here in Nambour. And what we found is, as the temperature increased as you went from winter and spring, the fruit became smaller.
So what exactly is this going to mean for strawberry growers, the fruit getting smaller over time?
Well, what happens, a plant with small fruit is a lot more expensive to pick than a plant with large fruit. So towards the end of the season, smaller fruit, it might take you four times to pick the fruit than it did early in the season. And we've noted that even in the trials here on the research station.
Dr. Christopher Menzel talking about the smaller size of strawberries.
On ABC Radio New South Wales, this is the New South Wales Country Hour.
5 minutes to one. We'll go to Griffith in a moment to see what happened there today, but with the Eastern Young Cattle Indicator pushing through to a new record of 900 cents a kilogram this week, you'd think the demand for Australian beef from other countries would be diminishing. But that doesn't seem to be the case. I spoke to Meat and Livestock Australia's head of market information, Stephen Bicknell, this morning, and asked him what was driving the price of cattle up.
What we have noticed sort of in the lead up late March, there were some supply disruptions from the rain and then obviously losing days to Easter. So there were limited yardings for the period preceding. But what we've definitely seen this week is that it's demand driven because yardings are up.
But they were up significantly, weren't they?
Yes, they're up significantly. So we had 14,000 head of cattle through Becky this week.
That's maybe 2 to 3 times what you'd usually get.
Yep. Well, through what in those periods where we had the sort of volatility and reduced yardings, yes.
What impact is that price having on the export markets? Because I remember when it was at 800, we were basically the most expensive beef market in the world.
Well, the reduction in exports is actually in line with the reduction in slaughter throughput. So we're not actually seeing it affect any, having any impact on export volumes, both down around 23-24%. But
over what period?
From January to March. So the price isn't what is driving the reduction in exports.
Is that surprising?
Not really. I think there is demand. That what we are seeing is maybe some markets, the change in sort of export markets and their makeup changing. So we've actually had some positive stories. So South Korea and MENA are actually both up year to date.
South Korea and who?
And MENA, so Middle East and North Africa.
Okay, yep.
So what we've actually seen is South Korea this year has become our second largest destination for beef. The percentage of cattle coming off grain feds increasing, so we are seeing more exports being grain fed.
And what's it like for processors right now? Because I get the feeling they might be losing money at the moment.
Margins would be tough just with the price of cattle and the AUD. I would say that. What we are seeing in the ECI breakdown is processors that are only 9% of all ECI cattle.
So what are they buying?
They're buying a bit out of feedlots. Their OTH prices, we saw surge at the start of this year when there weren't cattle around.
Over the hooks. You mean they're buying directly, or what does that mean?
Buying directly. OTH.
How sensitive are export markets, do you think, to those prices going up?
Well, as we said, it seems that the price sensitivities are not flowing through. We're seeing that exports, that there's still such strong export demand, and it's matching the reduced reduction in supply.
And is that because meat's going up all around the world, so comparatively we're not any more expensive, or is there just a shortage of protein? We know that in the pork sector they took heavy blow through disease, but what's going on with protein globally?
Well, protein globally, a very good question. A very good question there is that protein deficit out of China from ASF is definitely still at play, and we're hearing that there might be a second wave of ASF. So there is definitely still a global shortage of protein.
Stephen Bicknell from Meat and Livestock Australia talking about meat exports. Let's go to Griffith Sheep, Caroline Reynolds.
Good afternoon. Agents penned 6,500 lambs and 500 sheep. The quality was plainer this week, with very few trade weight lambs penned. An additional buyer joined the regular buying group, all operating in a firm to easier market trend. Trade lambs 174 to 204 were firm to $5 dearer in places, averaging 813 to 820 cents per kilo carcass weight. Heavy lambs, 25 to 26 kilos, 189 to 206, slipped $3. Extra heavy export lambs were firm to $15 easier, 208 to 236. The over 30 kilo lambs reaching $293. Merino lambs were softer across the heavy export types, selling from 198 to 217, easing up to $25. Mutton was softer, heavy merino used 202 to 215, and crossbred ewes sold up to $224. I'm Caroline Ronald for MLA at Griffith.
Thanks, Caroline, and all our livestock reporters across the week. That's the Country Hour for today. I'm David Claughton. You can find more rural information online on the ABC Rural Facebook page and on the ABC Listen app. Listen out for the Country Hour.